William Faulkner said that the past is not dead, it's not even past. Well, the way New Zealanders take on issues like giving women the right to vote, or the way we responded to an act of international terrorism on our soil, that becomes part of our DNA. Mandy Hager is an award-winning author who helps put history into perspective. Her latest book looks at four turning points in New Zealand and what they reveal about us: the suffragette movement, Pacific Island immigration and the Dawn Raids, the 1981 Springbok rugby tour, and the bombing of the Rainbow Warrior are all explored in Mandy's book. It's called Hindsight: Pivotal Moments in New Zealand's History. And Mandy Hager joins us now from Wellington. Hello there.
Hi, Jesse.
So what do you love about history?
Well, I think that it helps us understand who we are today. And we don't know that unless we can look at the past and kind of see what's shaped and formed us.
Why choose these four topics?
Well, on a pragmatic level, because the publishers asked me to write on these four levels, four issues. But actually, once I got into it, I realised that what all four of them are really about is ordinary people driving change, both at a kind of national and international level. So that was really exciting to discover and think about.
You want people to ask, what would I have done, right? Would I have helped the suffragettes, or would I have protested against the Dawn Raids or the racist South African regime? How hard is it to be honest with ourselves about that?
Well, absolutely, I want people to think about that. But I also want them to say, looking back on this, now that we know what we know, how has this shaped us as a people? And actually, how far have we come? Where are we now? And what extra work do we need to do? Because I think in all these cases, we've made these huge changes. But I saw patterns that were re-emerging with discourse that we see today, which is something I've noticed. I wrote a book about a 12th century French nun and the kind of issues she was facing.
You're such a crowd pleaser, Mandy.
Yeah, I know. But what really struck me was how we just keep kind of looping back to the same issues. And it would be really nice if we could draw breath and say, OK, how can we not repeat these same things again?
Yeah, interesting, eh? To look at, for example, climate change protesters in the same way as we remember Springbok tour protesters in 1981.
Absolutely. And actually, when I was on a recent climate change march, I had this real flashback to what it had been like marching in the Springbok tour, with the same kind of insults being hurled, like, you know, get a job and things like that. And I thought, boy, we haven't really come that far.
Wow.
We don't understand that, you know, people that take to the streets are passionately caring about what's happening and want to have a say in the kind of values that drive the policy of our country.
I guess at least with climate change in 2019, there aren't too many people marching in the opposite direction. It's more apathy and systematic change that you're fighting against.
Absolutely. Although I would say that it's also that there's just this huge wash of misinformation, and it's very hard for people to kind of pick through what's real and not real in the arguments anymore. And that's actually one of the main reasons I was pleased to write this book, which hopefully will go into upper secondary schools as well, which is about kind of being able to break down information and figure out what the sources are, what the biases of the writer are, whether the information is neutral or not, and actually the fact that even if something's presented as fact, it's always curated by a human being with an opinion. So kind of digging down into the analysis of why something's being said and who's saying it.
Is fake news a new thing?
No, I don't think so. I think it's just that because of technology, it's actually much harder for us to dig our way through it. And at the back of the book, I've got a little section on how to kind of actually combat fake news, and for people researching issues or reading into issues, how they can actually fact check, because it's just such a quagmire out there now. You can't even necessarily believe videos that you're watching. So, you know, how do we actually make informed decisions when we've got so much information coming from all sorts of different points of view and underlying ideas that people want to get across? So how do we get through that?
How much original research did you do for this book, or was it more taking what we already know and distilling your kind of or bringing it together and distilling your own view of it in context?
I did quite a lot of research, but of course it's all based on stuff that's already out there, but was able to dig down and found things like amazing master's and doctorate thesis that I could take information from. And because these days so much information's online and wanting to get this into secondary schools, most of it is I've referenced is available on the internet so that people can go and dig into it further.
Did you learn something from not just studying what people did, but studying what they didn't do? Does sitting on the sidelines of these major events say something about us too?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think that, you know, even if you say I'm neutral on this, I'm not going to take a position, that in fact is taking a position. And I think that, you know, that young people today, when they think about politics, they just see the kind of name-calling and antics that go on in Parliament, and it really kind of turns them off. And they're not realising that everything in their life is affected by the political decisions of our government, and that policy is shaped by the values of the people that we elect, and that it's incredibly important that they have a say in this. But also that all of us come from some kind of position. So up front I stated that my bias, if you like, in the research of this is that I was going to look at all these issues through a social justice and a human rights lens. And so I would love it if more people would kind of be up front and say, look, this is where I'm coming from on this issue. And then it's up to you whether you kind of agree with that or not. But I'm laying out my arguments for this position. And really it's about critical thinking. How can we dig down? How do we check the source? How do we check for conscious and unconscious bias? Our privilege, you know, I'm writing from a position of being a white person with economic privilege compared to some other people. You might, if a man was writing, you could say that he was writing from male privilege. So there's all these really kind of important factors that influence people's opinions and the stands that they take on things. And I think it's really important to pick that apart and be really upfront about it.
Side note, as a historical researcher, do you pity researchers 100 years from now who will have to sort through all our Facebook posts and tweets on a topic to try and work out what was going on?
Oh, God, it's going to be like some kind of crazy sci-fi movie, I think. It's just weird.
So they say history is written by the victors, Mandy. What insights can we get by looking at the losers, in this case, for example, the anti-suffragette view?
Well, I think just the fact that women have gone on to make incredible contributions to public life kind of destroys the argument that we should have just stayed home and done the washing. But you know, I do go into the kind of arguments that were made at the time against women there. And there were quotes by politicians sort of saying, oh, no, we can't have women in Parliament, particularly if they're pretty, because I would be so distracted by that I couldn't do my job. Mm. You know, just kind of crazy stuff. And it's quite encouraging to think, you know, that overall we've moved past that. But then kind of thinking, well, have we totally kind of reached a point of gender equality? And the answer is no, not by a long shot. And, you know, even in New Zealand, where we're incredibly privileged compared to women in most of the world, we still see huge imbalances.
One argument against universal suffrage was that not many women would want to vote anyway, but you discovered that wasn't true.
No, absolutely not. A huge amount of women who were eligible voted, in fact, more than the eligible men in the first vote, and it just kind of went up from there.
I'm speaking with Mandy Hager, who is author of the book Hindsight, Pivotal Moments in New Zealand's History. She looks at four key moments and goes a little deeper, and we're talking about the suffragette movement. By the way, why did it take until MMP arrived to see more women actually elected in New Zealand?
Because of gender bias, you know, because we have a society that's been built on male privilege and we're still in the process of breaking that down. And you still today see the way that women are treated differently in those positions than men. When our Prime Minister was voted in, you know, she was still questioned about her ability to govern because she was going to have a child. She's still kind of, a lot of the arguments that are pushed against her, this part-time prime minister kind of comment, are all really seated in sexist behaviour. So that's why I say that although we're much luckier than, say, my mother's generation and young women of my daughter's generation who are in, you know, she's in her early 30s, see huge change, there is still a long way to go in basic attitudes about women's right to have an equal voice and an equal say in issues.
Voter turnout in the local body elections was, I think, 48%, lowest in 40 years. I wonder if that might improve if more people were reading your book in high school and taking a moment to think about the history of voting rights.
Well, I really hope so. And I think that, you know, it would be really useful within the discussion that we're now going to have about New Zealand history in schools, that we also talk more about civics education and actually also analyse who's still being denied the vote in New Zealand. People in prison can't vote, for instance. You know, people in our lower economic groups often don't make it to the vote because they feel incredibly powerless. So how do we actually change those things?
The next topic in the book is the Springbok Tour of 1981. Interestingly, not the Dawn Raids, which chronologically happened first. Why not do it in time order?
Because one of the things I did in the section on the Springbok Tour was actually dig back into South African history and look at the kind of incremental changes that were made towards the final kind of apartheid policies that they had. And it was quite sobering to look at that, because if you took each one in isolation, yes, they were removing people's rights, but they were kind of tiny kind of adjustments. But when you saw the overall shape of it, it was a chipping away of rights to the point where there were no rights left. And I think that it's a really sobering and important message that we have to be constantly vigilant about our freedoms and our democratic process, that small shifts can actually take place over time that take those away. And I wanted to make that point before we got into the Dawn Raids.
The Springbok Tour is still living memory, by the way. How do you convey the depth of feeling about that tour to kids who have never known a South Africa under the apartheid system?
Well, I think then that when you tell the story of the kind of disruption that it took place at the time, you know, between groups of people within families, you know, families stopped talking to each other, held different positions. It was a very split time in terms of what people believed. And I think that when you also see the photos and you talk about what was happening in South Africa, and actually particularly the visuals really bring it home, just how awful it was, the kind of signs that were up, you know, whites only, the faces of people who were being shot at for protesting in South Africa, those images kind of get you right in the guts, and it's very hard to ignore that.
We hardly had clean hands, though, as far as race relations went in the late 70s and early 80s. Do you think in a way that 81 tour was a distraction from our own troubles?
Well, I don't know if it was a distraction, but I think that it was a really important moment. I think a lot of people talked about the Springbok Tour stuff as a growing up moment for New Zealand, but actually I see it more as an adolescent moment, because it was that moment where people were kind of fired up and passionate about something, but not really reflecting it back into their own lives. But actually over time, what people realised is, hey, here we are being incredibly vocal about this situation overseas, but we haven't really dug down into our own race relations. So I think that that was a moment of dawning for a lot of people, that actually this multicultural paradise, which we'd been sold the slogans on, wasn't in fact a multicultural paradise, and that we had to start looking at our own issues with race here. And the Dawn Raids also were very much part of that.
Yeah, there wasn't the same level of outrage when Pacific Islanders endured racism in the 70s from landlords and employers. Can you describe a bit of what people from Samoa or Tonga or the Cook Islands endured?
Well, it was incredible, really. So they were... told that they had to have their identification on them at all times, which had a real kind of reflection back to the past laws of the apartheid era in South Africa, actually. So that was quite hair-raising. There were basically policies to just pick up any brown-faced person on the street and check who they were. They were taken from their beds early in the morning and dragged out, and sometimes never saw their families again. They were just marched onto aeroplanes and flown home. A lot of people from the Cook Islands and from other places, you know, who were actually New Zealand citizens, also found themselves being caught up in that. But these were people who had been encouraged to come to the country at a time when we had a lot of real labour shortages, and they came in and filled the bottom rung of jobs. And then when the jobs dried up because of the kind of the oil crisis of the mid-70s and the shift when lots of tariffs came off, suddenly people wanted those jobs back for, quote, New Zealanders, and they were made the scapegoats for this, and they were just treated appallingly. And accusations went out about them being rapists and violent, and they were just really demonised. It must have been horrifying.
People were told if they wanted to come here, they needed to be Kiwis and leave their customs and culture at home.
Absolutely.
And that tension still comes up even in 2019, right?
Well, I think that's the thing that this really points to, is that all this ghastly rhetoric that was going on, this racist talk, it may have shifted slightly away from Pacific Island people, but it's shifted fairly firmly onto other immigrants, and the same kind of language and the same talk about, you know, having to assimilate and completely walk away from their cultural heritage. We're still hearing that stuff, and they're still being scapegoated.
So what exactly were the Dawn raids for people, younger people listening? What did the police do at the direction of the government?
They would turn up at somebody's house who they considered to be an overstayer, generally before work, so that they could catch people in their beds, and they would drag them out and take them away. And if they could prove that they had overstayed their work permits, they were just stuck on a plane or a ship and sent home without any say, without any rights to kind of fight that. So families were broken up. It was a very serious situation.
Did the young Pacifica people do anything to protest or rebel?
Yeah, well, that's an amazingly impressive story, really. So that's the time when the Polynesian Panthers formed, and they were a group of young people who decided that they were not going to allow that to happen. So they did some amazing things. For a start, they got people on board like David Longy, who was still just a lawyer at that time, who wrote them a rights booklet that they could distribute to people to say, these are your rights if you are approached or arrested by the police. They set up homework schools, they set up food banks for people. So they absolutely started supporting their community, just these young people, and forming a kind of support network for people. They had legal support. They would go to places like the big kind of booze barns, they called them at the time, so that they had people there to support anybody who was picked up by the police. They would follow the police patrols around to make sure that nobody was picked up who shouldn't have been. They protested, they lobbied, and actually towards the end they did some Dawn raiding of their own on immigration ministers to make the point of how horrendous it was to be woken from your bed, from your sleep, with people shining lights in your windows saying, we're going to pull you out for a Dawn raid. And actually, 2 weeks after the final time they did that, they finally got that particular process overturned. So they were incredibly efficient and successful in their protest action. And they empowered a whole generation of young Pacific Islanders to feel proud of who they were and to stand up for their rights, often against the advice of their parents and elders, who felt very much in debt to the New Zealand government and scared to rock the boat. So these young people were very brave in standing up against it.
Finally, the bombing of the Rainbow Warrior in 1985 by the French government. And David Longhi said there's only one thing worse than being incinerated by your enemies. It's being incinerated by your friends.
Yeah.
We're proud of our nuclear-free status, of standing up to the big boys, but I wonder if we're just looking at the bright side there. The French never really paid a price for what was an act of terrorism on New Zealand soil, right?
No, they never did, really. And they... it's interesting because they, for a long time, the people who were actually on the ground here just sort of disappeared, or they got, or the ones that were caught were put in jail and then secretly whisked away, so that they never really paid for what they did. It's a really weird one that they were able. It was an act of terrorism on our soil, and yet somehow they pretty much got away with it. But only kind of legally, because what it did was, Greenpeace had been quite a fringe organisation until then, and because it was an act of terrorism against them, it actually hugely raised their profile to the organisation they are today. So it was very counterproductive to what the French wanted. But also, that anti-nuclear stance and the fact that this had happened to us, you know, just really activated people to get out there and start to ask more questions.
Wow.
And it brought it right into the Pacific, you know. I think that was the other thing. It made us realise that this kind of fallout was going on next door to us, and that's what activated people to try and make change.
So tough question, Mandy, but what's the thread that ties all of these stories together?
Oh, it's absolutely people power. It's about ordinary people saying, look, there's something wrong here. We need a change in the values of the way that we're dealing with this, and demanding change at a political level, which is the thing that I think we all need to understand, that if we see something that we feel is really wrong, that it's important to voice that and speak up.
Also a reminder of what's normal is not always what's right, huh?
That's right, and that we can grow and evolve, and that the values of one era are not necessarily the values that we need to move forwards with. And also that we just have to keep vigilant, and that shifts can change. For instance, with the Rainbow Warrior one, really interesting to think that, you know, quite recently we had the law that was passed to prosecute people who were protesting out at sea about oil and gas mining out there. So, you know, all the time we have to protect our rights for free speech and to stand up against things that we don't believe in.
Hey, well done.
Thank you.
It's called Hindsight, Pivotal Moments in New Zealand's History. The author is Mandy Hager, talking about the suffragette movement, Pacific Island immigration, the Dawn Raids, the 1981 Springbok Rugby Tour, and the bombing of the Rainbow Warrior. Privileged to talk to you today, Mandy. Good luck with the book, and I hope it does end up in a copy in the hand of our secondary students, essentially the people we'll be relying on to protest in the future.
Exactly. Thank you so much for having me.